Severine Odasayer is the author of a new book, The Trouble with the Congo. Based on more than 330 interviews, it argues that international intervention in the Democratic Republic of the Congo in recent years has been deeply flawed because it has focused on national and regional level tensions and ignored the grassroots causes of violence. The book also suggests a new approach for peace building to avoid such mistakes in the future. Severine has kindly agreed to discuss her findings with Insight on Conflict. Thank you very much for agreeing to this interview. What would be very useful, I think, is if you could provide some kind of brief overview of the situation in the Congo. And I think that your view of what were the drivers of the conflict differ from the sort of dominant narrative of the causes of the conflict in the Congo.
Sure. So the conflict, I mean, you have had several phases in the conflict in the Congo, but let's say since 2003, there has been really an end to the major national and international conflict, and the beginning of a reconciliation between national and international leaders, so between the government and the various rebel groups, and between the Congo, Rwanda, Uganda, Angola, etc., etc. And violence has continued since 2003, despite the national and international reconciliation. And violence has continued at a very high level. So the dominant narrative on the reasons for the continuation of violence looks at national and international tensions. So it looks, for example, at the illegal exploitation of resources by foreign and national armed groups. It looks at conflict over citizenship. It looks at political conflicts between national leaders. And my analysis of the conflict looks instead at the local causes. So, and when I say local, I really mean at the level of the individual, the family, the clan, the municipality, the community, sometimes the ethnic group. And to me, really, social, political, economic causes of violence at the local level have been one of the major causes for the continuation of violence since 2003.
So in your book, you say that some of the national cleavages which are used to explain the conflict actually don't apply at the local level, or that things might be considerably more complex than those cleavages would suggest.
Yes. What I show in the book is that if you want to understand the conflict in the Eastern Congo, using only a framework of analysis at the national and international level, you will not understand why certain groups are fighting other armed groups, because they're supposedly allied with the same big player. You will not understand either why certain groups are allied with other armed groups while they are supposed to be on different side of the dividing lines of the national cleavage. So what I'm arguing is that if you want to understand the situation in each village, in each province, in each locale, you have to look at the local dynamics of peace and conflict in each single entity, and there only you can understand why people are fighting with one another or why they are actually making peace with one another.
Well, why is it you think that a different view of the conflict dominated from the view that you propose?
That's a very important point. It's something that I try to understand in the book, and in my analysis, that there are several elements. When I say we, I mean diplomats, academics, members of international organizations, even members of non-governmental organizations, are trained to analyze conflict from a top-down perspective, meaning we look at dynamics, political, social, economic dynamics at the national and international level. And many people that I interviewed for the book actually didn't even think that local conflict could matter. So I think it's first really because of just a training, a socialization process that we are used to analyze conflict from this really macro level perspective. And then there are other things that are more specific to things specific to the Congo. For example, the Congo was defined as a so-called post-conflict situation. And this label had a lot of consequences on how people understood the conflict. Something that is not Congo specific is also the way international organizations and diplomatic missions define their missions. And their missions is to work at the national and international level, not to be involved with local actors. So a combination of really general circumstances and Congo specific circumstances were together joined together to promote this narrative of violence as caused by macro level factors and not as caused by bottom up causes.
Just like to ask you how it was that people continued to view the Congo as a post-conflict situation after 2003, despite continued widespread fighting in eastern Congo.
So that was this question of how people could label a situation as past conflict while it is obviously very violent is actually something, a puzzle that motivated the book. And basically what happens is that in 2003, in mid-2003, I was in Goma working for Doctors Without Borders, and at that time we were dealing with a major emergency situation because there were major fightings just north of Goma, with a lot of violence, lots of human rights violations, displacement of the population. And then a high-ranking officer from the European Union arrived in Goma. She had spent a couple of days in Kinshasa, arrived in Goma, and started telling us that we should change the way we operate because now the Congo was in a post-conflict situation, so we should cross the front lines, etc., etc. And at that time, I remember I and many of my colleagues, we were really wondering what the person was talking about, because her vision of the reality in the Congo was very different from our vision of the situation in the Congo. And so that's what I started researching along with other puzzles. And so what the reason for the difference in perception and for basically applying the label conflict onto a very violent and conflictive situation apparently is due to a matter of procedural definition, among other things. And as I recall in the book, basically what diplomats and international organizations staff members have explained to me is that once you sign peace agreements, then you are in a post-conflict situation. So, given that the major warring parties, the national leaders and the international leaders, had finally signed a series of peace agreements, then by definition, we were now in a so-called post-conflict situation. And what's really interesting is first to point out that you call post-conflict when only national and international leaders. And so the behavior and the opinions of local actors just don't matter in this definition. And the other thing is something that I trace also in the book is what level of violence and what you needed for the Congo or the situation in the Eastern Congo to actually be called again a war situation and not a past conflict situation.
One of the things that you point out in the book that follows on from the definition of Congo from 2003 onwards as post-conflict is it reinforced the idea that the Congo was an inherently violent society, and that a high level of violence was somehow normal for the people of the Congo.
Yes, it's something that that was really really striking in the interviews and in the work that I did between 2003 and 2006 or 2007, and something that I find again now that I'm researching on another project is it's really this view of the Congo as an inherently violent country. And people, of course, won't tell me this using this word or straight straight away because it's basically a racist statement. So I don't think that anybody would put it with these words, but they will use language that really implies this vision. For example, you have massive violence ongoing in the province, and someone will ask me, "Oh, but you know, maybe it is just the normal way." Of it is just a normal situation for North Kivu, or you have a high level of rape in a certain village, and then someone I will ask one of my interviewees, one of my international interviewees, so why do you what do you think is causing this high level of rape? And then someone will tell me, oh, but don't worry, rape has always existed in Congolese society. So it's really something that I hear over and over again, this idea that a very high level of violence is so-called normal for the Congo.
In the book, you argue that one of the central arguments is that there was a too much focus on elections, ignoring many of the conflicts which continued at a local level. But do you feel an approach which aimed for a more substantive democratic process, might that not have taken more resources away from local conflict resolution?
No, I don't think so. Because anyway, there were so few resources devoted to local conflict resolution that I don't think it would have made a big difference. I don't think the choice was between elections and conflict resolution and local conflict resolutions or substantive elections and something else. I think the local conflict resolution was just not on the agenda.
What would your alternative have been to moving to elections? Would you disagree with the point that it was important to establish legitimacy for the government, or would you have had it as a lower priority?
No, I think it was important to have general elections and to have a democratic government for the Congo. What I disagreed with is how it was done. Basically, most of the resources and most of the efforts focused on the logistic and technical aspects of the organization of elections. So everybody was really concerned with moving ballot boxes and registering voters and making sure that everything, all the logistical and technical details were in place by the time the elections had to take place. And that was important, but the substantive part of the organization of elections, I think, was left out a little bit. So, for example, the international interveners didn't ensure that, for example, you had freedom of speech, freedom of campaigning, freedom to form associations. So it means that these freedoms, which are essential to any free, fair, democratic election process, these freedoms were not present all over on Congolese territory. So the process leading to the election did not ensure that the elections were free and fair. And also, I think there was a lack of action to really explain to the Congolese population what these elections were about and what was their rights. I did interviews in rural areas before the elections, and I heard things that really showed that there had been no explanation as to what the electoral process was about. So, for example, I interviewed rural women, and I asked them, "So, are you going to vote?" And they told me, "Of course not. We're women. We're not allowed to vote." Or I interviewed in another village. I interviewed someone, a woman again, and I asked her, "So, do you know what the elections are about?" And it was before the referendum on the constitution. And the woman told me, "Oh, yes, we're electing the advisor to the traditional chief." And I have more examples of these kind of misunderstandings in the book, but the bigger point is that from what I saw and from what other researchers have seen, the population was not really informed about what the elections were about. So again, you cannot really say that you had democratic elections where people could choose between various programs and various leaders and really make an informed decision. You had a process that technically was very smooth, but that substantively was a bit shallow or was very shallow. So my alternative would have been to work more on the substantive process. So spending more time and resources to really make sure that everybody understood their rights and everybody understood what were the stakes of the elections. Really make sure that all groups had the possibility to campaign freely and fairly, and so that you had genuine democratic, free, and fair elections. And that would have required more time. That's basically the main problem, is that in the framework for the transition to peace and democracy, elections were supposed to take place in 2 to 3 years. The problem is that in a country like the Congo, with the massive logistic constraints and the fact that it was the first democratic elections since Congolese independence, you would have needed much more than 2 to 3 years to really make sure that elections were democratic. My option would have been from the start to try to build substantive democracy in the Congo, and then taking all the money that we have spent since 2003 to promote protection of human rights, to promote to make sure that the population understood what the elections were about, to ensure that you had freedom of campaigning, freedom of press, etc. But also at the same time to ensure that you had a real peace in the Congo, not just national and international reconciliation, but also that you had peace at the local level, that communities had had the opportunity to talk about their differences, to resolve their differences, that you had development projects helping to rebuild link between the communities. And all that together, I think, would have created the conditions necessary for democratic elections. I really don't think that you can have free, fair, transparent, and democratic elections when such a high level of violence continues.
You describe the importance of working with local local actors, and you describe the local conflicts, but I wonder if you could just concretely say what sort of conflicts those would be that the local actors would address.
Sure. So, for example, in the Congo, you have a lot of conflict over land. Because of different legislations, because of displacement of populations, because of the conflict, you end up now with a situation where several families or groups or clans or properties have a legitimate claim on the same piece of land, and they continue to fight. They are fighting over a piece of land. And that's not something that you can resolve from Kinshasa, from the capital. You really need to go in each village, in each place, to understand understand the complexity and the different the reasons for fighting, and then you need to find a solution for each of this land conflict and for a solution that is acceptable to all the parties in conflict. So land conflicts are very important. Other conflicts that can be resolved by local actors or conflict over traditional power, which are extremely important here in the Congo, conflict over political power at the local level, conflict over administrative power at the local level, social conflict over the relative status of groups or families in a village, for example, or in a province, economic conflict. So again, I've talked about land, which is absolutely crucial in the Congo, but also conflict over the exploitation of local economic resources, like for example, mineral resources. So a lot of different local political, economic, social conflicts.
And I think at one point in the book you say that oftentimes it's just talking about the $50 needed to organize a meeting, or the $200 for people to travel between communities, and even at that level the resources are often, local organizations just don't have that. It was actually quite impressive to see how these organizations carry on their work in the absence of resources. It was quite humbling, I think.
I completely agree, and I also think that it's worth stressing that they carry out the work not only in the absence of resources, but also in conditions that are absolutely terrible for them. Many of them put themselves in danger, and they put their family in danger just because they believe in what they are doing, and they believe that they are helping the different communities. So I think even us as international actors, we're always, in an easier situation and an easier position than these local actors. So that's also one of the thing, one of the reason why I think it's so important to amplify their voice and to relay their messages. It's because they are so focused on what they're doing, and sometimes they don't have access to, the international media and all the resources that we as international actors have access to.
What would you say to the argument that, however, Monarch or the diplomatic missions, that institutionally they were not capable, or they were not the right people to try and work on those conflicts?
I say that I completely agree. I would say that institutionally they are not the right people, and that is why, as we were talking about before, we absolutely need to put local actors in the driver's seat, and they should be the primary responsible for working with local conflict. But again, usually in the Congo and in many conflict places, they need support from international actors. For example, they need funding. Most of the organizations I met here in the Congo were telling me that they absolutely needed more funding. They needed logistical resources. Sometimes they needed technical capacity. And very often they were also saying that there are larger dimensions to their conflict. So, for example, provincial or national dimensions, and that they need national actors to help address these dimensions. Or there are military dimensions in this conflict, and a local non-governmental organizations cannot doesn't have the weight necessary to deal with military actors. So that's when you need the involvement of the peacekeeping mission. So that's the first part of the question. And then the second part is that it's not because, I mean, they are not institutionally able to do that. But that can change. And that's also what I'm arguing in the book, is that if we understand and if we acknowledge that local conflicts are actually extremely important in many conflict and post-conflict situation, then one of the conclusions is that have to make sure that organizations that intervene in conflict situation and in post-conflict situation are wired and are able to support local conflict resolution. So we need to have experts in local conflict resolution who can actually better help the grassroots actors. We need to have more flexible funding. We need to have different funding. And we need basically to change a little bit the bureaucracy and the standard operating procedures.
Do you think that provides a real challenge to the institutions?
I think it does.
Yes.
I think it's a huge. Sorry, I cut you. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask, might that explain some resistance to more bottom-up approaches?
Yes. Yeah, I think there will be a lot of resistance. For example, that is one of the things that I document in the book. During the period that I study in the Congo, there were calls by local actors and by some international actors. There were calls for more support to local conflict resolution. And these calls were ignored, and the person was sidelined and sidestepped and sometimes marginalized. And I link that to resistance for organizational reasons and for personal reasons. So, making international organizations and diplomatic missions more able to support grassroots actors will face a lot of resentment, a lot of resistance. But still, it's one of the main challenges that we are facing now, and we can just try.
Okay, and how do you believe we might get to a place where more bottom-up approaches are used or are integrated with top-down approaches?
I think what we really need is first an acknowledgement that local conflicts matter and that local conflict resolution is legitimate in post-conflict and post-conflict situation. And for that, we need concerted efforts by all the actors who work in local conflict resolutions and who are already doing this kind of advocacy work, but also by researchers, academic researchers, by journalists, also journalists who can highlight the detrimental effects of local conflict and the positive effect of local conflict resolution. And we need an acknowledgement, I think, really from top level people in really the highest ranks of the hierarchy of the international organizations and the diplomatic missions. We really need the most high level people to say and to acknowledge and to tell their staff that yes, local conflicts are a major cause of violence in many areas, and therefore yes, supporting grassroots actors is a legitimate task for the staff, and it is a priority in many environments. And then once you have this acknowledgement, then we can create new bureaucracies, we can hire new experts who are experts in supporting local conflict resolution and local peace building. And then these experts can create the units and the standard operating procedures and the funding mechanisms that are best to work with local actors, and then you can have a trickle down effect and you can have local conflict resolution better supported in most places. But I think from the start, what we really need is an acknowledgement that local conflict resolution matters, because what I've seen so far, and it has changed a little bit in Congo now in the past, I would say, 3 to 4 years. But still, there is really this idea that local conflict resolution is just a second priority. It's something to do once we've done everything else, once we have done national reconciliation, international reconciliation, elections organization. We should really acknowledge that that local conflict resolution is a priority on par with national and international conflict resolution.
Your book is based on over 300 interviews, so I think that your book would those interviews would have been an occasion to bring this argument about the importance of local conflicts to top-level policymakers, to leading figures in international organizations. What sort of response did you get to your argument from those people at the sort of higher levels?
Well, first, I must say that I did not bring this argument very often. Because at the beginning, I was just trying to understand what was the situation and what were the dynamics of violence. And then once I had developed my analysis, then I didn't want to bias the response of my interviewee. I wanted really to make sure that they were telling me what they thought was happening and not what they thought I wanted to hear. So it's really, in most of my interviews, I was just asking quick questions. I was not talking much. But then usually when I didn't bring up the question of local conflict resolution, I had a lot of misunderstanding. So for example, people would understand local by national. As when you say local actors, they would tell me about the president and the major rebel leaders, not about really individual villagers and local group, what I call local groups. So misunderstanding very often, or they would start talking about sexual violence as if local violence was somehow restricted to sexual violence. And then when they did understand the question properly, the way I really meant it, then they were either surprised and wondering why I asked what political or diplomatic actors were, international political or diplomatic actors were doing for local conflict resolution, as if really it was, they shouldn't even think about it. It was really not of their business. And usually they would refer me to their development partners or to NGOs that they worked with, humanitarian NGOs or development NGOs. And when I insisted and I kept on asking questions about, yes, but what do you do about this local conflict that is political and military, very often they became annoyed at me or they started laughing at me. Or they started looking at their watch very pointedly and looking again and then sighting and then looking at their watch. So basically showing me that they were getting bored with my questions. So a lot of different reactions, but which to me showed that local conflict resolution was really not on their agenda.
But you do suggest that perhaps over the last few years that might be changing a little bit. As we move further from 2006?
Yes. There are a couple of things. So you should know I was in the Congo working on the book until 2007. Then I stayed outside of the Congo to really write the book and try to understand. And then I went back. I've been back to in Congo for now 2.5 months. And something that I found striking is that now people are talking to me about land conflict, which is something that 4 years ago I would talk about land conflict and I would usually have a blank stare from international interveners. Now they are actually mentioning by themselves work on land conflict and how land conflict matter and land conflict is important. So that's, I think, a big change. Another big change is that now the UN peacekeeping mission is organizing local dialogue between communities and supporting local dialogues, local reconciliation. And there is more support to local reconciliation. So I think it's a step in the right direction. It's a step in the right direction. It's great. But still, we could go so much further. So for example, now there is a UN agency that is dealing with land conflict and that's fantastic. The problem is that in this agency, it's UN Habitat, and they have, I think, 7 staff and 1 car to deal with the whole of the Eastern Congo. So again, it's great to have 7%, but you need 10 times or 100 times the number of people they have and the amount of resources. You need many more corals, you need many more resources. You have people talk about land conflict. That's another good step in the right direction, but they talk about land conflict usually only to mention the return of refugees from Rwanda. So they talk about land conflict. When they talk about regional reconciliation, they don't talk about the importance of land conflict for local conflict resolution. And I wonder if they would actually talk about land conflict if it was not related to international reconciliation. So you have steps in the right direction, but to me, it's still far from enough.
Okay. So if it fits within the sort of national level cleavages, it can be more easily understood and therefore more talked about than local level conflicts. I'd just like to...
Yes, exactly.
I'd just like to ask about to what degree... Your book focuses entirely on the Congo up until... the last chapter, and you refer to some lessons it might have for elsewhere. I'd like to ask you how applicable you think the lessons you learned in the Congo are for other conflict situations.
Well, I think you cannot take the entire framework of analysis and apply it to another conflict. But I think you can take a lot of different elements from the analysis, a lot of the different lessons, and use them to understand the reason for peace-building success or peace-building failure in other conflict. And here, for example, you can look at research by other scholars like Stathis Kalyvas or Scott Strauss, who work on other conflict and who have shown that local antagonisms matter in most conflict situation. And I think if that is true, and I believe that it is true that local antagonisms and local agendas matter in many other places beyond the Congo, then we need local conflict resolution in many places beyond the Congo. And again, you can look at the work and the analysis of various NGOs and various think tanks who show that local conflict resolution is needed, for example, in Liberia, in Ireland, in Somalia, in Somaliland, etc., in Darfur, etc., etc. And then what I think is really the main lessons from the book is trying to understand why we don't have more support to local conflict resolution. And this idea that we approach conflict from a top-down perspective, it's something that we see in many conflict situations. We see it in Iraq, we see it in Afghanistan, we see it in Somalia, we see it in the Sudan conflict, both North South, but also the Darfur conflict. We see it in Timor. I mean, we see it really virtually everywhere. The idea that supporting local conflict resolution is illegitimate is also something that you see in many different areas. The idea that people are inherently violent and therefore we don't need to do local conflict resolution because it's just normal way of behaving for them. It's something we have heard we have seen in the Congo, but also in the former Yugoslavia. Very often when I was working in Kosovo, I heard people telling me, oh, it's just ancient age hatred. You know, these people have been fighting for ages. There is nothing we can do. So again, that's something that is applicable beyond Congo. The whole idea of the post-conflict label and the kind of strategies that this label will promote and enable is something, again, that we have seen in many other conflict situations in Afghanistan, in Iraq. So I really think that we can use lessons from the book and use them to better understand the approach to local conflict in many places beyond the Congo.
Your book has created, I think, a lot of interest to people interested in peace building and also people interested specifically in the Congo. I wonder if you could tell me what the sort of what the response has been like to your book so far.
I'd love to know. I don't know. I've been in Goma most of the time working on my new project. To be frank, I've been in the US and in Europe just 2 weeks recently. But again, I was very much working on my new project, so I don't know much what the response has been. Maybe in a couple of months I will be able to tell you. So far I've just had people email me and tell me that they liked the book and it was very useful, or telling me that it helped them better understand the situation in Iraq or in Israel or in Haiti or whatever. But I think people will not email me to tell me they hate the book. I'll only have it, you know, there is a selection bias. I'll only have the very nice positive answer, which is great. I mean, I don't want Haiti now. So far that's the only thing I've seen, and again, you know, I'm in Burma, my internet access is terrible, so I cannot really follow a lot on the internet, and I'm not in New York, I'm not in Paris, talking regularly with people who can tell me about how the book is being received. I've heard from my friends that the book is very well received, but again, they are my friends, so they won't tell me anything else.
Well, you're obviously very aware of selection bias, but if I can add my voice to the other people who've said how illuminating the book is and how useful, and it's interesting to see a book that takes such a fresh angle on a conflict and can present a convincing case which runs counter to the sort of dominant narrative. So thank you very much for the book, and thank you ever so much for taking the time to talk to us. A Peace Direct and Insight on Conflict. It's extremely generous of you. On a bad line from Goma.
Well, thank you so much for your kind words.